Compass Media Networks. This is America's First News. This weekend with your host, Gordon Deal.
Football warning signs. I'm Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
High school football has seen declining numbers for more than a decade. That's just one of the issues that NFL owners are addressing to save the game.
On the tech front, as the holiday shopping season arrives, hear what cyber crooks are rolling out this year to steal your data.
By today's measurement, stocks have been at sky-high valuations for three decades. Is it possible those yardsticks are outdated?
And a new debate begins in the Marine Corps now that umbrellas are allowed.
The umbrella decision has been tried six times to get through the system since 1974, each time failing. And this year, it finally went through with approval from the Commandant of the Marine Corps for all male Marines to be using umbrellas. Females could use them since 1972.
Wall Street Journal reporter Ben Kessling, who served as a Marine, joins us to discuss his story entitled Semper Dry. Well, the warning signs are up for football. Over the course of 11 years now, nationally, high school football participation in 11-man football has fallen more than 10%. It's falling all over the country, too, on the coasts, in the heartland, upper Midwest, deep South, California, Florida, Texas. Ken Belson, national football writer at the New York Times, has a look at the issues. Ken, who are some of the people putting their heads together about this?
They're businessmen at various levels. So some of them are billionaire owners, and others are collegiate commissioners, others are former players. And their sport has been under attack from all directions, mainly from issues around safety, but also from other sports, particularly on the youth level, where more and more parents are pushing their kids into AAU baseball, basketball, soccer, and so forth. And so when the participation pipeline shrinks, it potentially threatens a high school collegiate and ultimately the NFL.
Yeah. All right, so for parents, it's really about head safety here, I would imagine, correct?
Yeah, that's the main issue. I mean, that's evolved over the last, decade or so. And I think from the perspective of the National Football Foundation, which started this campaign, they feel like there's a lot of misinformation, a lot of hyperbole, that the stats being produced don't necessarily compute to the average football player's experience. And so they're trying to educate or at least add some balance to the national conversation about it. It's a tough thing to do because you're talking about scientific issues and you're mixing that with parents and kids who may or may not want to play, and there's a lot of competing interests, but this is basically their way of saying there's more to the story than that's out there now.
I thought it was interesting. You took a look at Maiden, North Carolina, this small town, right, considered a football town, and you posted a team picture from 2008. And then one from today. Boy, it looks like half the population of the team would have disappeared.
Yeah, a little less than that, but yes, about a third of the team, varsity team. And as the athletic director told me, his town, which is not that large, only a few thousand kids or a few thousand residents, some of the neighboring towns have shuttered their JV teams and so forth. So it's happening across the region, not just that particular high school.
Wow. We're speaking with Ken Belson, national football writer at the New York Times. Did you say, too, that there are actually some states considering broadly to eliminate tackling as part of the sport?
There are several bills, or there are bills in several states, New York, Maryland, Illinois, Massachusetts, California. They've been introduced. They are mostly aimed at banning tackle for kids 12 and under and promoting flag football as a replacement. None of the bills have proceeded to any sort of full vote in any of the state houses, and some of them perhaps are something of a lark. But I was at a hearing last week or 2 weeks ago in New York City where two of the legislators on the health committee, the state assembly health committee, actually brought in speakers from both sides, both coaches and others defending youth football and scientists and others who are saying it's prudent not to let kids under 12 play tackle football. And so it's at least advanced the stage of hearings. Whether it advances much further, I can't really say right now.
Yeah. I guess as part of that conversation with regards to injury, we are seeing some elite level teams, right, just getting rid of pads altogether on certain days or just not practicing using hitting but maybe one day or something like that to minimize the wear and tear on the body.
Yeah, actually, that's a good point, that a lot of teams at many levels, college particularly at Dartmouth has, and the Ivy Leagues overall, are already taking a lot of measures. It's not like football has stood still, but over the last 10 years, and particularly over the last 5 years, more coaches and athletic directors have been proactive. And let's face it, you spend a lot more time practicing than you do in a game. A game is 60 minutes, obviously, potentially all hitting. In practice, you're practicing many more days. So there are many more injuries, actually, in practice, and so coaches have gotten smarter about curtailing the amount of full contact. The NFL has done this in its last CBA agreement back in 2011. And in fact, coaches have been penalized, or teams have been penalized, for exceeding the amount of full contact practices allowed. So the NFL is taking it seriously. Some of the colleges are. And it stands to reason, you know, in the old days, and I've had former players tell me this, you know, they were beating each other up once and twice a day. So by the time they got to Sunday, they were relieved. They didn't have as much hitting as they were.
Wow.
I mean, that's old school, but
and
those days have really gone away. But it makes sense. Why would you pound yourself into a pulp during the week and not save something for the actual game? So the Ivy League has banned full contact practices during the season, and that's quite radical. I mean, you may not see that at the higher level football, collegiate football levels, but it is a big step.
Thanks, Ken. Ken Belson, national football writer at the New York Times. 13 minutes after the hour on This Weekend.
Now that Human Resources Director Fernando Pino has Kronos for HR, payroll, talent, and time, he's completely crushing it. He even has his own hype song.
Supporting our entire workforce. Everyone has different hours, skill sets, and pay grades. Motivating and engaging our people every step of the way.
Kronos, HR solutions for the modern workforce and the people who support them. Learn more at kronos.com/HR swagger.
I'm on the top, I'm gonna rise up. I'm on the top, top, I'm gonna rise up. I'm on the top.
Thanks for being with us. Just as kids and consumers get excited for the holiday season to give and receive gifts, cyber crooks get excited too, but with the intention, of course, of taking rather than giving. So what's new in online ripoffs this year? We're joined by Craig Williams, who works in threat assessments for Cisco Talos. He's got some ideas on how we should be on the watch for things like too-good-to-be-true emails from unrecognized websites. Craig, what should we know?
Well, I think what a lot of people don't realize is that holiday shopping is really a time for cyber criminals. They look at it as an opportunity. You have all these users around the world, especially in the United States, that are looking for a way to save money. You know, everybody wants that deal. Everyone wants to have a little extra money over the holidays, and it makes them very vulnerable.
Yeah, it's funny. I saw a friend of mine who should know better, who's roughly my age and has been around these things for a while, like, share something on Facebook that said, like, you know, Costco gives you $75 gift card. All you have to do is share this post. And I thought, really, like, does that really make sense when you think about it, that, you know, millions of people could be doing this and they all want to get $75? That's the type of stuff. I don't know if that's necessarily a scam or just a spoof, but that's the type of stuff that's out there, right?
Absolutely. There's that kind of thing. You know, another one that's popular this season is mystery shopper scams. Well, they'll basically pretend to give someone a massive gift card and say, hey, please go to this business, buy a couple of gift cards for yourself, buy the following for us, and then, you know, obviously you get to keep the extra, and then it turns out the check that was sent to them was fraudulent, it bounces, and then the victim is stuck out of pocket with the money and has already sent the goods to the attackers.
All right, so what's new in 2019 for cyber crooks? What do we have to watch for?
Well, we're seeing a lot of rise in politically charged attacks, right? Due to the election season, people are using political motivations to spin people up emotionally so that they forward links and they click on stories maybe they shouldn't. You know, a lot of people understand that going, and giving information over email is dangerous, and it certainly is. But it's also dangerous just to even click on those links, right? If you go to a website that's been crafted to exploit your web browser, simply viewing the page is enough to potentially compromise your machine.
All right, so does this stuff ramp up around Black Friday and Cyber Monday in terms of, in terms of shopping emotions?
Absolutely. You know, Black Friday and Cyber Monday are the busiest shopping season in the United States. And as a result of that, people are out there looking for deals online. And that's really what allows attackers to, use that as a lure to get those people in, to get them to view those malicious emails, to click on those malicious links, and then potentially lose some money.
And clarify here, too. I mean, it's one thing to open the email itself, but when you go over the line is when you click the email attachment, right?
Well, it can be either way. There are attacks that can be embedded in the email body. Now, opening an attachment is obviously very dangerous, right? There's lots of complexity and common, office documents these days, and attackers will take advantage of those to exploit things. That's why it's so important that people go in and turn on automatic patching where they can now.
Mm. We're speaking with Craig Williams. He's the director of outreach for Cisco Talos in Austin, Texas. We're talking about steering clear of holiday shopping scams. You said, too, like fake invoices could pop up.
Absolutely. You know, fake invoices, fake coupons, links to deal sites to get a special deal. You know, one of the things we see a lot is that a website will impersonate a major shopping site. And when the user goes there and enters their credentials to buy, whatever the item is at a deal, well, it turns out the link that they clicked on isn't the real site, and they just gave their credentials to the attackers.
You get the sense that as consumers, we're better at detecting this stuff, or are the cyber crooks still a step ahead of us?
I think we're actually very good at detecting it, right? I can have a conversation with my grandparents, and they understand what a phishing email is now. So we've made great strides. Now, the problem there is that this is a business, and like any other business, bad guys are trying to innovate, and they're thinking of new creative ways to compromise users. And so we've got to stay on our toes. We've got to be sure that we're aware of the situation. You know, the way I like to think of it is locks have been around a long time, and no one's built an unpickable lock. And I think we're going to see the same type of innovation by the bad guys, and that's why as good guys, we've got to stay on our toes. We've got to keep our game up and make sure that people are aware of these threats and how to defend against them.
Thanks, Craig. Craig Williams from Cisco Talos. 21 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for being with us. Consumers, salespeople, and lenders are treating cars a lot like houses during the last financial crisis by piling on debt to such a degree that it often exceeds the car's value. This phenomenon, referred to as negative equity or being underwater, can leave car owners trapped. More from Anna Maria Andriotis, consumer lending reporter at the Wall Street Journal. Anna Maria, what's happening?
A growing share of car owners are finding that when they go to turn in their car to buy the next car, they still owe money on their previous car, specifically because they owe more on that car than it is actually worth. So essentially what has been happening is more and more people are finding that their car loans are larger in size than the value of their car.
Right. All right. So why are they doing this? Not because they want to, I guess.
Well, correct. So the main issue here is really it comes back to the terms of the loans that people have been signing up for. In recent years, the repayment periods that have been assigned on loans have been getting longer and longer. So whereas car loan repayment periods were typically around 5 years long, the 7-year repayment periods are becoming more common, and in some cases even longer than that. Ultimately, the main problem here for people occurs if they try to trade in or to sell their car while they still have an unpaid balance on that loan. Because what they will often find, and this is why we rewrote this story, is that a growing share of these people are finding that even when they sell their car or trade it in, the price they get for it is lower than the loan balance that they owe. That remaining loan balance isn't just something that gets wiped out.
Yeah.
Those people are still on the hook to essentially pay that lender back.
I mean, the stat you quote in the story, 33% of people who traded in cars to buy new ones the first 9 months of this year had negative equity.
That's right. And we had to look at that number several times just to be sure that that was, in fact, what the figure was saying. This figure is up from about 28% 5 years ago and 19% a decade ago. Also, the dollar amount that they are underwater on has grown. So on average, these people owed about $5,000 after they traded in their cars, before they took on the new loans. That $5,000 was about $4,000 5 years ago. So not only are a growing share of people owing negative equity, but the amount that they're, of negative equity that they owe is growing.
We're speaking with Anna Maria Andriotis, consumer lending reporter at the Wall Street Journal. She's written a piece entitled, "More Borrowers Are Going Underwater on Car Loans." I'm not sure if it's necessarily a snapshot of what's going on more broadly, but it seems like the folks you talked about in this story and their issues involved American trucks or SUVs.
So what they have in common is that, for the most part, people who are affected by this, by being underwater with negative equity, for the most part, their cars are not high-end cars. You know, these aren't people who've splurged on the latest models, highest-end vehicles. These are pretty normal cars. And that's what we heard as well from consumer lawyers we spoke to, you know. Do people with high-end cars get into this situation? Sure. But the vast majority of these cases are people who are essentially getting normal cars. They might be SUVs, and who oftentimes might not have the best credit as well. Or they don't have the means to pay off the remaining balance. But increasingly, people in this situation are kind of, you know, sort of everyday normal people. Yeah. We're not talking about just this impacting only subprime people. We're not talking about, you know, high-end cars either. It's sort of your sort of run-of-the-mill, everyday type of consumer who wants to change or needs to change their car for some reason, finds that they owe more in it than it's worth, roll over that balance, and increasingly what's happening is we're seeing repeated rollovers, like the individual, one of the individuals we included in our article, where they can roll over once, twice, three times, and so forth, and then before you know it, you owe $18,000 more on the car than it's worth.
It's frightening. Anna Maria Andriotis, consumer lending reporter at the Wall Street Journal. 30 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Hey, what's longer, your watch list or your reading list? For me, it's definitely my reading list, but there are not enough hours in the day. Then I found Blinkist. Blinkist is the app that condenses the need-to-know information from thousands of nonfiction books down to 15 minutes that you can read or listen to. It's great on a commute. I like it as a refresher for books like The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. I'm catching up right now on all kinds of history that I never learned in school. With Blinkist, you get unlimited access to read or listen to a massive library of condensed nonfiction books, all the books you want, and all for one low price. Right now, for a limited time, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/morning. Try it free for 7 days and save 25% off your new subscription. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T. Blinkist.com/morning. To start your free 7-day trial. And you'll also save 25%, but only when you sign up at Blinkist.com/morning. Thanks for spending time with us. Coming up this half hour, why Marines are debating umbrellas, and a Texas couple gets married at a hospital. We'll explain why in about 20 minutes. Well, of the 11 major automakers that provided data to USA Today, none had women in more than 23% of their U.S. vice president or higher positions as of the end of the second quarter. We get more from this weekend's Jennifer Koshenka.
Despite the high profile of GM CEO Mary Barra, the auto industry is still very much a boys' club at the top. Nathan Bomey of USA Today has written about the leadership in the sector and joins us now. Nathan, let's talk about Barra. How has her tenure gone?
Well, I think Mary Barra has been widely credited with a pretty successful tenure so far at General Motors. You know, she took the office only a few years after the company emerged from bankruptcy, and I don't think that success was predetermined at all. So, you know, she's led the company to bigger profits, to resiliency in a market that's now starting to decline, and, you know, has led the company through some really tough decisions as well. And, you know, of course, women are unfortunately stereotyped often as not being able to make the tough calls, and she's done that. So, you know, I think by all accounts, she has really led this company to success. And so the question is, why has that not inspired other auto companies to promote women into the leadership ranks?
And what is the answer to that question?
Well, you know, I think that we obviously face a lot of societal issues, of course, that are affecting all of corporate America and the entire auto industry as well. But the auto industry actually trails corporate America when it comes to promoting women into the upper ranks. So this is a significant concern. And the data that I gathered for USA Today, you know, it showed that none of the major auto companies has more than 23% of their U.S. executives as women. So, you know, that means that, you know, that we got a lot of room to go here. Even GM, which has made a lot of progress, is not doing so well there. And although the good thing is that GM has a majority women board, believe it or not, which is the only one by a long shot. So Mary Barra has had an effect there. But when it comes to turning the Titanic around, that takes a lot of time.
We're speaking with Nathan Bomey of USA Today. Nathan, did outsiders and analysts think that Barra would open more doors for women?
I think so. When you look back at the coverage of the appointment of Mary Barra, of which I contributed because I was working for the Detroit Free Press and covering General Motors at the time, a lot of the sentiment was that this was a real inflection point, that her appointment would actually lead to more diversity in the industry. And, you know, it just really hasn't happened. You know, you look at across the board, there are no other women leading any major automakers, and there really aren't that many in the C-suite either. Mary Barra's not waiting for other people to take action. She's appointed a woman now as the CFO of GM, so you know that could mean one day that she could actually be in position to succeed her as CEO. So, it's happening in spots, and I think that the encouraging thing is that most of the automakers understand this is an issue where they need to improve. So the question is it lip service or is it a real commitment?
Nathan, your story points out that Japanese and Korean automakers even are further behind than U.S. automakers. Is that just a cultural thing?
I think it's an important question to be asking because, you know, especially because this is not just an altruistic thing. The fact is that companies with women in the leadership ranks and on the boards actually statistically are more successful. This is a proven thing with research and studies that have shown this. And so this is not just about doing the right thing, which of course we should, but the reality is financially these companies would actually be better off if they did this.
This weekend's Jennifer Koshenka with Nathan Bomey at USA Today. It is 21 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend.
Round here, everyone knows you need the right tool for the job. It's the difference between orders filled and orders missed, between return customers and product returns. That's why I order from Grainger. With over 250 local branches, will call product pickup, and a time-saving mobile app, it's easy to get it right. When it comes to getting what you need, when you need it, Grainger's got your back. Call, clickgrainger.com, or stop by to see for yourself. Grainger. For the ones who get it done.
Thanks for joining us. U.S. stocks have been at nosebleed valuations for much of the past three decades, or so say the yardsticks used to measure stock market value. But personal finance expert Jonathan Clements is asking, what if the problem isn't the lofty price of stocks, but rather the yardsticks we're comparing them against? He's the founder and editor of HumbleDollar.com. Jonathan, how do you see this?
Well, if you look at what's happened in the U.S. stock market over the past 30 years, stocks have looked extraordinarily expensive by historical standards. Whether you compare the price of stocks to corporate earnings, you compare them to the dividends that are paid, you compare them to the value of corporate assets, every one of those indicators, you know, is ringing the klaxon and saying, get out, this market is incredibly expensive and bad things are going to happen. But is that really the case? I mean, this has been going on for 30 years, and so the question naturally arises, is it really that stocks are way overpriced, or is it that the yardsticks we're using to measure stocks to say whether they're overvalued or not are in some sense broken? And I think it's, you know, a mixed story. Yeah, I think stocks are expensive. I think there is a risk of a significant market decline. But stocks are not as expensive as they seem because there are some fundamental problems with these yardsticks that we're using.
All right. So explain a couple of them here and how you see it.
So take dividends. If you look right now, the S&P 500 companies are yielding 1.9% in dividends. That compares to a 50-year average of 2.9%. So if we were going to get back to historically average valuations, you know, we'd have to have the S&P 500 drop by a third. But the big but here is a lot of corporations are paying out less of their cash as dividends and instead using it to buy back stock. So if you take the percentage of stock that is being bought back by the S&P 500 companies each year, and you combine it with that 1.9% dividend yield, what you find is the combined dividend yield plus buyback yield is over 5%. So in fact, companies are paying out a lot of cash to shareholders. They're just paying it out in a different way from the way they have historically.
We're speaking with Jonathan Clements, founder and editor of HumbleDollar.com, and he's written a piece about today's yardsticks for measuring stock value. Explain the earnings yardstick.
Yes, the earnings yardstick is really interesting. You go back, you know, 30, 40, 50 years when we had, you know, an industrial rather than a post-industrial economy, you know, the way that major corporations made money was they would sink their dollars into new factories, they would get new equipment, they would put up new buildings, and then they would slowly depreciate the value of these investments that they made, these capital investments, over the useful life of the equipment. And that meant that the hit to reported earnings was relatively modest. Now you think about today's superstar companies, companies like Facebook, you know, Alphabet's Google, you think about Apple, you think about Netflix. You know, these companies are not building factories. They're not putting up huge office buildings. Instead of these big capital improvement projects, what they're doing is research and development. They're building valuable brand names. They're collecting, they're creating intellectual capital. And when you do that, that research and development expense is an immediate hit to corporate earnings. So the earnings of these companies, if they were traditional industrial companies, would look much higher than they do. But because they're spending their money on research and development rather than on traditional capital improvements, the earnings look lower than they really are.
Thanks, Jonathan. Jonathan Clements, founder and editor of HumbleDollar.com. It is 13 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. If, when you hear Audible, you just think audiobooks, that's understandable. They do have the world's largest selection of audiobooks, but that only really scratches the surface. Now they've added Audible Originals, too, stories created exclusively for audio. There are documentaries, scripted shows, and exclusive audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else, but you can listen to everywhere you go with the Audible app. If you're a member, you can choose one audiobook regardless of price every month, as well as two Audible Originals from a fresh selection. And those are yours forever, even if you cancel. I still listen to my copy of How to Win Friends and Influence People by Dale Carnegie, and it's how I keep up with one of my favorite authors, John Grisham. Start listening now with a 30-day Audible trial. Find some of your favorites or some new ones. Choose one audiobook and two Audible Originals absolutely free. Visit audible.com/Gordon or text Gordon to 500-500. That's audible.com/Gordon or text G-O-R-D-O-N to 500-500. Thanks for being with us. For hundreds of years, Marines have endured the elements. The official uniform regulations are crammed with rules about how hair should be parted and what color socks are allowed with combat boots. They also made clear most Marines were not allowed to carry an umbrella. In an about-face, though, the service retreated from the ban last week, kicking off a debate within the Marine Corps. Wall Street Journal reporter Ben Kessling speaks from experience about the issue, having served as an officer in the Corps. Ben, where does this come from?
It's unclear exactly where the impetus for this latest change came, but in the Marine Corps, a uniform change can be brought about by one lowly Marine who decides to make a request for uniform change. If it's endorsed by his commander or her commander, then it goes up through this convoluted process where it finally ends up at the Marine Corps Uniform Board, which is the gatekeeper for all decisions. They survey the force, then it goes to the commandant for a final decision. The umbrella decision has been tried 6 times to get through the system since 1974, each time failing. And this year it finally went through with approval from the Commandant of the Marine Corps for all male Marines to be using umbrellas. Females could use them since 1972.
Right. So who can actually carry one? Because it's not everybody, right?
Well, so like everything else in the Marine Corps, there's a Byzantine rule book for the wear of uniforms, okay? So you don't have to worry about thinking about Marines trading in rifles for umbrellas anytime soon in the field, and with the camouflage utilities, no umbrellas allowed, okay? In formations or something like that, you're not going to see a parade deck full of people with umbrellas. This is approved for when Marines are wearing dress blues or the green service uniform, and, you know, like walking from point A to point B on a base, getting out of the car, going into some place, just sort of, you know, the way that you would use an umbrella if you were in a business suit or something.
I'm thinking of something like on a serious note, like the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. Those guys would not qualify?
That is correct. So in those sort of very formal situations, you don't have to worry about Marines wearing or having umbrellas in those situations. They're not going to be used for those formal settings.
All right. So as some listeners may or may not know, you served in the Marines. When you saw this come down the line, your personal reaction was what, Ben?
Gordon, my personal reaction, I'm agnostic on the thing, but my personal reaction was immediately, as soon as I saw this, I knew that, as somebody I interviewed for the story told me, there's two things that the Marines are good at. One is fighting wars, and the other is complaining about things. And complaining about uniform changes is one of the prime things that Marines are good at. If you talk to any Marine, about uniform issues, that you'll hear arguing, complaining about whether or not they can put their hands in their pockets when they're walking around in the field, and why they can't wear white socks with combat boots. These are just two of the sort of mysteries of the universe that Marines will always argue about, and so umbrellas just gave them one more thing to complain, argue, parse. You know, I knew as soon as I saw that, everybody be arguing about it.
Thanks, Ben. Ben Kessling, Wall Street Journal reporter. It is 6 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for being with us. A Texas couple ensured the groom's father was a big part of their day after he was unexpectedly hospitalized and required emergency surgery. Fox News says Michael and Aaliyah Thompson celebrated their marriage with two ceremonies in September, the first taking place at Baylor Scott & White Medical Center in Sunnyvale. Not long before their scheduled wedding, William Thompson, the groom's father, was hospitalized due to complications with his diabetes, according to KXAS-TV. He developed a sepsis infection and required emergency surgery. Knowing it was impossible for William to make their formal wedding, the couple chose to bring the wedding to him in his hospital room. Michael and Aaliyah were required to wear surgical gowns during the impromptu ceremony and placed the wedding rings over gloved fingers. Nurses at the hospital also helped the couple celebrate the special moment by providing cake, flowers, and grape juice. Later that day, the couple was wed once more at a church. William, by the way, has since made a full recovery. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koshenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend.
Michigan is one of the best places in the country to do business. But you don't have to take our word for it. Take Evan Miles, CEO of Roush Enterprises, instead.
For the people that are involved in product development, there couldn't be more unique and exciting opportunities that are really going to shape the future of the world. It's a really exciting time to be in Michigan.
Big things are happening in business here. Find out why by searching Michigan Pure Opportunity.